This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington, and it's the Friday News Roundup. There have been increasing signs that this year, Election Day will likely stretch into Election Week or even Election Month. President Trump did nothing to quell those anxieties this week when he refused to commit to a peaceful transfer of power in front of a room full of reporters.
Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transferal of power after the election?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
I understand that, but people are rioting. Do you commit to making sure that there's a peaceful transferal of power?
We want to get rid of the ballots, and you'll have a very we'll have a very peaceful. There won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation.
Democrats, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, immediately leapt on the comments.
You are not in North Korea. You are not in Turkey. You are not in Russia, Mr. President. And by the way, you are not in Saudi Arabia. You are in the United States of America. It is a democracy.
Tensions are boiling in the United States as the coronavirus death toll crosses 200,000 and protests over police violence reach a fever pitch in the wake of a grand jury decision in the Breonna Taylor case. Here to shed some light in the middle of all this heat is Anita Kumar, Politico's White House correspondent. Anita, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Also with us, Devlin Barrett. He covers the FBI and the Department of Justice for The Washington Post. He's also the author of October Surprise, How the FBI Tried to Save Itself and Crashed an Election. Devlin, welcome. So let's start with the grim milestone the United States hit on Tuesday, 200,000 deaths from COVID-19. And the number of daily new cases countrywide is rising. It's been going up for the last 2 weeks, reversing a downward trend that goes back to mid-July. Anita, give us a quick snapshot of the country's status as of this past week.
Well, the coronavirus continues on, even though people are starting to talk about other things. We did hit 200,000, and actually in several states, many states, the infection rate is still going up. And, you know, as the country braces for phase two over, you know, in this winter time. So, you know, things continue even as people are getting out and going out. And that's part of the reason it's continuing, right? People aren't doing what federal officials and public health officials are telling them. And so the number keeps going up.
Well, and early this week, the CDC found itself in a scandal after it removed information from its website. An update last Friday provided more information about the risk of airborne transmission, specifically indoors. But on Monday, the update was removed. Anita, what's going on here?
Well, this is the same thing that we've seen now several times over the last several months with the CDC, where they have essentially changed their mind or gotten some influence causing them to change what they're doing. They've done this with schools. They've done this periodically with other things about who should be tested. You know, the department says, the CDC says, nothing has changed, that they're learning things about this virus and they're updating as and telling the public as they know. But others are saying that the White House has influenced some of those decisions, and that's why they've changed things. Administration officials are telling us and telling other reporters that it's influenced by the White House, which very much wants to move on from this, wants people to get back to school, get back to work. And there's that influence. So things that generally didn't go to the White House for them to approve or look at are now being influenced by that.
Devlin, how does this add to the concern about how information is being shared with the public and adding to the public's lack of trust in the information that's being shared?
Well, it obviously creates doubt in everything. So even public official announcements are greeted with a higher level of skepticism. And, you know, some skepticism, I think, is probably good and helpful and productive in this process, because there are unknowns as we go through. But what you're seeing is you're sort of seeing this sort of grinding politicization of all sorts of parts of the government. You know, I think at one point it was the FBI, and now it's, you know, the very health professionals. And we've gotten to the post office now. Like, all these things are becoming these sort of political footballs, and it's making it harder and harder for the average person to really know what to trust.
Well, calls for CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield's resignation followed this week's scandal. Anita, are those calls likely to gain any traction?
You know, the White House and the president says that they are supportive of Dr. Redfield, but you're right. Those calls are from health officials. The morale is very low in the department. There are a lot of people that think that he isn't fighting back against this politicization the way he should. So, you know, at the moment, we don't hear anything from the White House, but I will caution there are times that have nothing to do with coronavirus about any number of staffers around the administration where one day they're in favor and the next day they're not. So it really does depend on how things continue to go, what Dr. Redfield says publicly. As you've seen over and over, President Trump has criticized public health officials, including him, when those officials say things that the president doesn't like. So really, it's an everyday thing. We have to watch how that relationship goes.
Well, and just remind us, Anita, how states use information disseminated by the CDC as they're making decisions about how to approach the control of the spread of coronavirus in their states.
Yeah, I mean, early on, the president made this decision that he would sort of delegate to the states what to do. Now, some people would say that he just can't have certain mandates at the federal level. The states really do need to decide on these things. So, but regardless, the president said early on, it's up to these individual states to decide what to do. But they are getting that health information from the federal government, from these scientists. So they're very much looking at these guidelines. What should we do? What benchmarks should we use to reopen, to go to these different phases, phase one, phase two in these states? So, you know, it's not a mandate, but the states are very much looking for health information from the federal government about how to move forward.
We're talking to Politico's Anita Kumar, Devlin Barrett of The Washington Post, and bringing another voice into the conversation, Fernando Pizarro. He's a Washington-based political reporter and a journalism professor at American University. Fernando, it's always great to have you with us.
Hi, Jen. Happy to be back.
Well, the FDA found itself in the crosshairs of President Trump this week after it announced a plan to issue tougher standards for emergency approval of a coronavirus vaccine. The president responded to a reporter's question on Wednesday.
Well, I tell you what, we're looking at that. That has to be approved by the White House. We may or may not approve it. That sounds like a political move, because when you have Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, these great companies coming up with the vaccines, and they've done testing and everything else, I'm saying, why would they have to be, you know, adding great length to the process?
Fernando, what are the tougher standards the FDA is looking to put in place, and why?
Well, the Food and Drug Administration is going to tell vaccine manufacturers that they need to wait at least 2 months to give volunteers, people who are participating in clinical trials, the second dose of a possible vaccine before they can get what the government calls an emergency use authorization, which is the mechanism that these companies need to make the vaccine widely available. Now, the Food and Drug Administration will issue these new standards for this emergency approval for the vaccine, but the White House now is attacking that as a political move. Many people, as polls show, think that the administration is using the early assumption, especially pushed by the president, that a vaccine may be ready by November 3rd, that is, by the election, and that this obviously goes, these new regulations probably would push the approval of the vaccine in the United States way past Election Day, maybe not even in November. And that's not exactly what the president is being talking about, is suggesting publicly all the time that the vaccine will be ready before that.
Well, and Devlin, this comes amid increasing concerns about the politicization of the vaccine approval process. What, if anything, is the FDA doing to ease those concerns?
Well, I think what they're trying to assure people is that they are not going to recommend something that's not safe. But I think at the same time, you have people, particularly among skeptics of the president, who are saying, look, there's clearly some pressure being exerted on these agencies to make things look and sound better than they probably are. So how do we trust these agencies? If the agencies say it's to trust us, is that something we should do? And, you know, obviously there are a lot of folks who are senior health officials in the government who are trying to assure the public, we are going to do this the right way, we promise. But the more this stuff gets argued about and the more that you see these back and forths, it becomes harder to just take them at their word.
Well, Dr. Anthony Fauci, director at the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, went head-to-head with Republican Senator Rand Paul at a committee hearing on Wednesday. Dr. Fauci explained that New York's low coronavirus numbers were a result of citizens following CDC guidelines to lower risk. Then Senator Paul fired back.
Or they've developed enough community immunity right. that they're no longer having the pandemic because they have enough immunity in New York City to actually stop.
I challenge that, Senator.
I'm afraid, sir,
I would like to be able to do this because this happens with Senator Rand all the time. You were not listening to what the director of the CDC said, that in New York, it's about 22%. If you believe 22% is herd immunity, I believe you're alone in that.
20 seconds here, Anita. Briefly, this points again to this tension between what public health experts are saying and some elected officials are saying about how to slow spread of the coronavirus.
Right. The herd immunity just basically means a number of people are immune to because of the vaccine or mass infection. But Dr. Fauci is saying that's not true. There are not enough mass infections there to be herd immunity.
Well, Max on Twitter says Trump's claim that there won't be a peaceful transfer of power, but a continuation, as long as we don't count all the ballots, is the stuff of dictatorship. Didn't we just condemn the same thing in Belarus? We're talking about the week's top headlines with Politico's Anita Kumar, Devlin Barrett of The Washington Post, and Fernando Pizarro, a Washington-based political reporter. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment. I'm Jen White, and it's the Friday News Roundup on 1A. We're talking about the week's top headlines with Politico's Anita Kumar, Devlin Barrett of The Washington Post, and Fernando Pizarro, a Washington-based political reporter. And with you, what stories caught your eye this week? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@wamu.org. After 2 days of honors at the Supreme Court, on Friday, late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg became the first woman and first Jewish person ever to lie in state at the U.S. Capitol. Anita, why hasn't a woman ever held this honor before?
That's a great question. You know, they've been doing this tradition since 1852, and it hasn't been as many people as you might think. It's been about 35, so a lot of presidents, other people, but mostly or obviously, this is always for someone who serves in the government. Four civilians have also been honored, but it's not called lying in state. So Congress decides who does this, and you know, obviously many elected officials in this country until more recently were men.
Well, Devlin, before the Capitol, Justice Ginsburg lay in repose at the Supreme Court. Can you describe what this remembrance was like and who came to pay their respects?
Well, pretty much the entire city came to respects, and it was an interesting mix because it began as sort of a spontaneous demonstration of support and remembrance that the very night of her death outside the Supreme Court. And then obviously it morphed into the official pageantry of remembrance. And, you know, I think the video that is probably going to be most lasting from that is people chanting against the president when he showed up. You know, I think it says something about the state of our politics right now that even in, you know, a memorial setting, that the political anger is so great that people are going to essentially boo the president in public. And that just tells you what the stakes are, that, you know, her death is obviously sad and obviously a moment in history. But it's also another front in this political battle that we're following.
Fernando, what can you tell us about Justice Ginsburg's funeral plans and where she'll ultimately be laid to rest?
She will be laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery next to her husband, Marty Ginsburg, in the section that is reserved for members of the Supreme Court. This Friday will be the only day that she will be lying in state in the U.S. Capitol. And as Anita said, it's a historic moment. It's the first woman, first person who's Jewish to lie in state. Let's remember that Rosa Parks laid in honor at the Capitol Rotunda, but that was 2005. And that is the distinction between laying in honor and laying in state. Only four people have lain in honor at the Capitol Rotunda. That's Reverend Billy Graham and two Capitol police officers that were shot dead in a shooting in the Capitol in 1998. And then Rosa Parks in 2005. But yes, this will be Speaker Pelosi has given the honor to Ruth Bader Ginsburg to be at the Capitol to lie in state. Apparently, there are some interesting absences as far as we know. Maybe Mitch McConnell and other members of the Republican leadership not showing up to this event. So. That will be something interesting to see what the symbolism of who goes to pay respects to Justice Ginsburg at the Capitol.
Well, there's a looming battle in the Senate over who will replace Justice Ginsburg on the bench. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell appears to have enough support to vote on whoever President Trump nominates this weekend. The president saying he'll make that announcement on Saturday. Anita, right now we note two Republican senators, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, have said they think the nomination process should wait until after the election in November. First, a distinction here, after the election, not after the inauguration if a new president is elected. And that's an important distinction to make.
Right. They basically want to see who wins the presidency. That president, they're saying, should decide what comes next. That is a distinction. There's a lot of people back and forth about whether this should, even on the Republican side, whether the hearing should be before the election, it should be after. But overall, it does look like the Republicans, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, does have the numbers. Only these two people have said that they are opposed.
And how firm are Collins and Murkowski in their stance?
Well, they seem firm. I mean, what's going to happen starting next week after this announcement is that the White House is going to have this woman, it is going to be a woman, come around to Senate offices. And we'll get a good idea then about whether Democrats and these two Republicans are willing to meet with this person, right? Because if you'll remember, 4 years ago when Barack Obama nominated someone that did not go through, Merrick Garland, Republicans didn't even meet with him. And they said, what's the point of having this meeting? We know we're not going to vote on this. So that's going to tell us something. That's going to give us a signal about what's going to happen. But I will note that there are other critics of the president. There are other people that we thought might take the same stance and say, let's hold off. I point to Mitt Romney, the senator from Utah, who has gone back and forth with the president on a variety of issues. He actually said, let's let this go forward. So I think that people were really looking at him to say, is he going to be, I think they'd still even need one more person, but people were really looking to see if he would say yes or no. And everybody else has said they want to go forward on the Republican side.
At this point, what's the likelihood of other Republican senators changing their position?
I think it's really unlikely. The Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, feels very strongly that he has those votes to go forward. Now, look, a couple things can happen. We'll see when all this happens. We see the announcement on Saturday, but we'll have to see what the vetting comes up with and what those hearings look like. But they've already looked at the calendar. They're looking at the week that they want to have the hearings, the week that they want to have the vote. So clearly, the president and Senator McConnell think they can push this through. They feel good about those numbers.
Devlin, what options do Democrats have on the table at this point to try to delay this confirmation?
Convert a Republican or two. This is really, the Democrats can make as much noise as possible, and they can do sort of performative things and argumentative things. But the magic number here is four, that the Republicans basically, if the Democrats want to stop this from happening, the Democrats need to peel off four Republican senators to their argument here. And so far, as Anita points out, they really only have two. And the other thing to remember is while there are Republicans who are disenchanted, let's say, with the president, the issue of judges is one on which the Republican Party is very unified and very committed. Mitt Romney may dislike President Trump, but Mitt Romney likes conservative judges. So I think it's going to take something like a political miracle for the Democrats to peel off those other two senators. But, no one can predict the future, so we'll have to see how it plays out.
Well, as we said, President Trump is expected to announce a Supreme Court pick Saturday evening, and most court observers say Judge Amy Coney Barrett of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals is the overwhelming favorite. Fernando, let's just start with the background. Who is Amy Coney Barrett?
Well, she is a longtime favorite among conservatives. She's 48 years old. She went to Notre Dame University Law School. She was a professor there. She is now a judge in Chicago at the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. She has had for a long time a very conservative positions on particularly she's on abortion rights. She's very pro-life. She's had decisions on gun rights. She's had a very conservative approach to interpret the Constitution. Many people say that she is very much like the late Justice Antonin Scalia, as what it's called, an originalist, and somebody who likes to interpret legally the original intention of the framers of the Constitution. She's also Catholic. And even though she has not ruled directly on abortion rights as a judge, many say that she has, she would be maybe a possible justice who could rule against Roe versus Wade.
Well, in 2016, Barrett suggested a conservative-leaning Supreme Court would leave in place the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision on abortion, but give states more leeway to impose restriction. And this is her speaking at Jacksonville University at the time.
I don't think the core case, that Roe's core holding that, you know, women have a right to an abortion, I don't think that would change. But I think the question of whether people can get very late-term abortions, you know, how many restrictions can be put on clinics, I think that would change.
Anita, your thoughts. I mean, Barrett said that before Trump was elected. Do you think there will be a push for an outright reversal of Roe v. Wade with a 6-3 conservative court?
I do think there will be a push. There are many people that are looking for that. I would just say that she said that as you said, before President Trump and before this court changed, it was most recently 5-4 on the conservative side. And then obviously with the death of Justice Ginsburg, now we're at 3 on that liberal side. So, you know, she would make that 6 if she was on there, whoever the president puts in, if they get confirmed. So I do think there's going to be a push. There are a lot of people on the conservative side, on the Republican side, that want her merely for this and other issues. So I think there would be a push. The question of whether that would go through or not.
Devlin, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's right. I also think, you know, if Barrett or someone like her gets on the bench, that would be a major shift in the power balance on the court, obviously. And I think everyone involved sort of realizes the stakes. You know, she's also signaled through her relatively short judicial career that she's very pro-gun rights. So that would be another area where I think you could see a significant amount of shift in terms of Supreme Court decisions. And look, I think the stakes are incredibly high for the Supreme Court, in part because so many issues are now, so many policy decisions are now practically being made by the court, including, Obamacare and a bunch of others.
We're talking to Devlin Barrett of The Washington Post, Fernando Pizarro, a Washington-based political reporter, and Politico's Anita Kumar. I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. Let's talk about what happens as we move farther along in this process. If President Trump is able to add his nominee to the Supreme Court, Fernando, do Democrats, are they truly considering trying to add more justices to the court?
That's been something that's been mentioned several times. I believe Vice President Joe Biden has decided not to want to get into this. He was asked the very same question at some point, but he said he didn't want to get into this because then it would become a political point in the campaign. But yes, there are some Democrats that see this as a reason to expand the Supreme Court because they feel that if Trump gets a nominee through this year, even before or after the election, but before a new Congress and the new president and takes over next year, then they would they would have the chance to, to take, as Devlin was saying, to make change the balance of the court significantly.
Anita, your thoughts. What are you hearing from Democratic lawmakers, if anything, about the seriousness of this consideration?
You know, I think they are serious, but I think it really depends on a couple things. One, obviously, who wins the White House. And if, it is a President Joe Biden and he's not supportive, that's not going to go anywhere. Also depends on who wins the Senate. You know, we don't know what that's going to look like. We'll have to see in November. But I think there are a lot of considerations. It's not just, enlarging the Supreme Court. I saw today a progressive House member is introducing a bill that would limit the number of years on the Supreme Court, so you could serve 18 years. So I think there are a number of things that Democrats would look towards, but they really need to see what happens in November.
Well, another case that's going to come before the Supreme Court is a challenge to the Affordable Care Act. The hearing is scheduled to take place 1 week after the election. Fernando, what's at stake with this Obamacare hearing in November?
Well, on November 10th, the Supreme Court is scheduled to hear another case on the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare. Whether the Trump administration and 18 Republican states that have pushed this lawsuit feel that the whole law, Obamacare, has to go because there's no more individual mandate. Let's remember, Congress changed and eliminated the individual mandate penalty for people who didn't have health insurance, which was an important, essential part of the Affordable Care Act. So now they feel that if this doesn't, if this is not there, the Supreme Court has to decide to eliminate the whole and bring down the whole law down with the decision. Many Democratic leaning states, their counter lawsuit is that. Their counterpoint is that this would leave out about 20 million people without health insurance. And now let's remember that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was part of the last two major decisions in 2012 and in 2015 that basically consolidated the ACA after the cases that were brought before the Supreme Court.
Well, Devlin, voting has already started in some parts of the country. How much of an impact is this Supreme Court vacancy having on voters and swaying their decision in one way or another, or getting just more people out to vote because of this open seat?
So the conventional wisdom on voters and the Supreme Court is that it motivates Republican voters very much, and it tends not to motivate Democratic voters as much. I think what you're seeing at the first blush is some indications that more Democrats may be more energized and more motivated precisely because of the Supreme Court issue. But I think the data is a little soon to really know for sure, I guess is the way I would put it. The other argument, frankly, is that Democrats are plenty motivated already. They don't need any extra reasons to vote this year. So I do think it adds to the stakes. It adds to the motivation on both sides. But I also think, if you look at the traditional voters for both parties, they're already sort of running at 11 as it is. So I think, if they get to 12 or 13, that's interesting, but it may not affect a great deal.
And briefly, Anita, how has this shifted the Biden campaign strategy, if at all?
Oh, I think it has shifted. They're really pushing on this. They've been talking about coronavirus, and now they're starting to talk about this. And they're really saying, look at what's at stake here. We mentioned the Affordable Care Act, and they're saying, look, healthcare is on the line. It's not the only thing, though.
We're rounding up the week's top headlines with Politico's Anita Kumar, Devlin Barrett of The Washington Post, and Fernando Pizarro, a Washington-based Politico reporter. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment. Let's get back to the Friday News Roundup with Politico's Anita Kumar, Devlin Barrett of The Washington Post, and Fernando Pizarro, a Washington-based Politico reporter. Well, President Trump justified his decision to rush a Supreme Court confirmation this week. He says the court could be crucial in deciding the outcome of the election.
I think it's very important. I think this will end up in the Supreme Court. And I think it's very important that we have 9 justices. And I think the system is going to go very quickly. I'll be submitting at 5 o'clock on Saturday the name of the person I chose for this most important of all positions.
Anita, The Atlantic published a story this week outlining how President Trump could subvert the results of this election if he loses. How would seating a 9th Supreme Court justice help him in this effort?
Well, there are cases, you know, there are a couple things. There are cases right now that are going to the Supreme Court in individual states. I'd point to Pennsylvania that had a ruling about when ballots could come in and be counted, what that deadline is. That's being appealed, so it's going to the U.S. Supreme Court. Right now, obviously, they're missing a justice, so it could impact that. But the president's been pretty clear that he is planning on probably contesting some of these states' results and quickly litigating that. So if they go quickly through the court system and they could end up at the Supreme Court, and he would like 9 justices there to make those decisions. You know, it really depends on what happens, how close these individual states are. But the Trump campaign is targeting 17 states. They feel like many of them could be very, very close, like they were in 2016. So indications are that they plan on contesting and in the court system.
Would there be any expectation that that presumed 9th justice would recuse herself because she's just been appointed by President Trump?
Well, I think that how the Supreme Court works is if you're not present for those oral arguments of a particular case, or you're not present when that case starts, then you sit it out. But generally, I don't think so. You know, obviously, there's 2 other justices on the Supreme Court that the president appointed that are going to deal with, that have dealt with and are dealing with several things that have come straight out of the administration. Even his tax returns and financial records, and both of the justices he appointed, nominated, and then got confirmed, dealt with that case.
Well, the president, again, refused to commit to a peaceful transition of power, saying, get rid of the ballots and you'll have a very peaceful, there won't be a transfer, frankly, there will be a continuation. That's a direct quote from President Trump. But we got this email from Stan who says, why do we spend time talking about the president's refusal to commit to a peaceful transition of power? Don't we understand that this is the president's latest head fake, a rerun of his the elections rigged episode from fall 2016, a distraction from his pathetic performance in this season's COVID-19 plotline? Just stop. Devlin, what do you make of what Stan says there, that this is just a distraction?
Well, look, I think there's 2 things going on, right? One is a very, I think, fair and legitimate debate about what is the safest and best way to conduct an election during a pandemic. And 2, you know, I do think that part, to Stan's point, I think part of the challenge here is how do you discuss these things rationally and calmly without getting into hysterics when the president loves to just, you know, take a flamethrower to every discussion. And so, you know, it becomes very difficult to have a conversation about, you know, even small issues of voting irregularities when the White House, you know, trumpets, as they did yesterday, you know, a case that involved apparently 9 ballots in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. You know, these are not the issues on which the Republic will probably rise or fall, but sometimes we debate them as if they are. And so I think it's worthwhile to sort of always have a measure of calm in how you discuss these hypotheticals and, you know, see what actually happens versus what you're afraid of happening.
Well, Anita, as someone who covers the White House, I'm really curious to hear your perspective here.
I hear this over and over again. I mean, it's a good argument. There are so many people like this caller who think it's all a distraction, and particularly right now that it's a distraction from the coronavirus response of this administration. But, you know, I think over and over again, I've seen the last 4 years that many times things that the president kind of just says, some of those things, you're right, he doesn't come back to, he doesn't follow through on, but a number of them he does. And so I think that people, Democrats and his opponents, really do take these seriously because They don't know what's going to happen. And they worry that in 5 weeks or whenever this is in the election, that he will fight that. And they want to be prepared for that. So I see both sides of it. It really depends on what it is and what you believe the president will do on that particular topic.
Well, lawmakers have reacted since the president made those remarks. Here's Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont speaking on Thursday.
Let me make this clear to Donald Trump. Too many people have fought and died to defend American democracy. And you are not going to destroy it. The American people will not allow that to happen.
Fernando, what have we heard from Republican lawmakers? What have they said about the president's refusal to commit to a peaceful transition of power?
Well, here we've seen a more clear and reaction, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who issued a statement. He even told Fox News that the winner of the November 3rd election will be inaugurated January 20th. So the same has come from other Republican lawmakers. Mitt Romney went even further. He compared it to Belarus. He said that this would seem like protesters are complaining about the re-election of the president Alexander Lukashenko, which seems to be have some issues there. And he felt that that all these statements from the president are unthinkable and unacceptable. And I wanted to add something as a reaction to what Anita and Devlin were saying. About that caller as well. I think presidential words do matter. As someone who grew up abroad under a regime that was very far from being democratic, when a president of the United States, in this case, something that is not something we see all the time, questions the legality of ballots or questions the democratic process, it is more than just a distraction. I think his words have an impact on many people, whether they are just empty threats. They are presidential words and statements that are putting the whole democratic process in the U.S. in question.
Well, and Anita, when you have the president saying, get rid of the ballots out loud, and we're at a time in this country where Americans have a fundamental distrust in the institutions that are supposed to serve us, is there something deeper at work here that we should be really concerned about?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at polls, people are saying they don't know if their vote's going to count. They are worried about that. They're worried about the post office. You know, they hear what the president says. I think Fernando's exactly right on this. Words do matter. He is the most powerful person in this country. What the president of the United States says matters, whether he follows through on it or not. So there is that. You know, we're so used to this president sort of shattering the norms on so many different levels. Sometimes it is that language. Why is he saying this? I mean, does he really think that your election, your vote doesn't matter? That's really of concern to a lot of people.
Well, we got this email from Andrew who says, I keep hearing about the peaceful transfer of power after the election for the office of the president. I'm wondering what a non-peaceful transfer of power would play out in the U.S. Would we just not have an executive branch? If there's no executive branch, are we reliant on Congress? Anita, that's a great question.
It is a great question. It's actually something I've been reporting on this week. There are so many different avenues this could go down. I don't think that anyone thinks that the president or anyone else was referring to non-peaceful in terms of war or battles or anything like that. I do think that there could be a lot of lawsuits and litigation. I think state legislatures could get involved. I think the U.S. Congress could even get involved. I mean, this is a very remote possibility that legislatures and the House would be involved, but there's actually a path for that to happen. So I think fighting until the last day, until January, when we figure out who this is what people mean by that, as opposed to what we've seen in the past, which is when people are voted out of office, they work with the new administration in all those different agencies to help them understand what they're going to have to know, take this massive undertaking of the U.S. government and have a smooth transition.
Devlin, I want you to maybe pull the curtain back a little bit for us and share a bit about the conversations you're having in your newsroom about what election coverage looks like November 3rd and beyond, because the likelihood of us having a decision on November 3rd is a bit shaky.
Right. I think, you know, that the standard expectation is you would normally know late in the evening or, you know, very early morning hours who the winner was and who the loser was. No one can guarantee that. And I think there's some good reason to think that it will take longer than that this time. I think as reporters, what we're talking about is, okay, it may be tense, but we're going to have to just, you know, for one, be on our toes. And two, you know, I think a lot of what we talk about as reporters is, you know, make sure that we're not falling for any disinformation. One of the things when you talk to the U.S. intelligence officials who deal with election interference is they're most concerned in some ways about the period after Election Day. If it is in question, what kinds of fake false things might be pumped out on the Internet to confuse and upset Americans and make them, you know, distrust whatever the outcome ends up being. So I think, you know, what I think of it as sort of, you know, the deep breath lesson, which is you're going to have to work through it and you're going to have to figure out and make sure and double check that every single piece of information you're getting is correct.
I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. We're talking to Politico's Anita Kumar, Devlin Barrett of The Washington Post, and Fernando Pizarro, a Washington-based political reporter. Well, switching gears a bit, on Wednesday, a Kentucky grand jury announced felony endangerment charges against one former Louisville police officer for his part in the raid on Breonna Taylor's apartment in March, where she was shot and killed by police. The jury did not bring charges against the other officers involved, nor did they charge anyone with killing Breonna Taylor. Here's Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron speaking to the press about the decision.
Criminal homicide encompasses the taking of a life by another. While there are six possible homicide charges under Kentucky law, these charges are not applicable to the facts before us because our investigation showed and the grand jury agreed that Mattingly and Cosgrove were justified in their return of deadly fire after having been fired upon by Kenneth Walker.
Fernando, give us more details on the grand jury's decision.
It's interesting to add, Jan, that the Kentucky Attorney General, who is an African-American and a Republican, when he announced his grand jury decision, said that he understood that there would be pain and that he understood that not everyone would be satisfied. The issue with this is that we have to look back at the case. They found that there were 32 shots fired. Officers shot her six times, and as you mentioned, they are facing no charges. And former Louisville detective Brett Hankinson, who did not shoot Breonna Taylor, as I believe you mentioned, he was charged with reckless endangerment for firing into the neighbor's apartment. Her boyfriend at the time did shoot back at the police officers, but he had also made a call believing that intruders were getting into the apartment. The whole issue here is that the police officers keep on saying that they did make a verbal warning that they were coming in, but many other neighbors feel that that warning was not properly heard. So that's been one of the issues at hand here about what kind of warning the police officers gave. Again, also the sheer amount of firepower that came down on this apartment is just unbelievable.
And I just want to be clear, Officer Brett Hankinson was charged with three counts of wanton endangerment. You know, Anita, I think it's interesting to note that Attorney General Cameron, as Fernando said, a Republican, spoke at the Republican National Convention last month, and he talked about the importance of law and order. He referenced Breonna Taylor's death. But this has been going on for months now, and I wonder if that decision on his part has further politicized this.
You know, definitely. I've seen criticism. There are a lot of people that are criticizing this decision not to charge in her death. And a lot of people are saying it's because he's Republican. It's because he's close to Senator Mitch McConnell. It's because he's close to President Trump. And you saw the president praise him for this decision. And, you know, that only takes it a step further. And so I do think everything is political now. And this is definitely one of those things.
Well, Devlin, protesters took to the streets in hours after the decision. Two Louisville police officers were shot, and a suspect in that shooting is now in custody. Quickly bring us up to speed on the officers who were shot and what we know about the suspect.
So we don't know a ton about the suspect at this point, but we know the officers are expected to survive. They're not believed to be life-threatening injuries. But, you know, I think what's so awful, and I've covered law enforcement a long time, I think what's so awful about this current moment in America is the degree to which you're seeing a real breakdown in trust and faith between the citizens of cities and their police departments. And, you know, Louisville is the latest and most vivid example. But you're seeing this same dynamic play out in a lot of American cities right now.
But briefly, I think some people would say that breakdown has been ongoing for decades.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I think the fact that so many of these confrontations are now on video makes the debate much more unavoidable. I think frankly, when I started in the dark ages, you know, this kind of announcement would be done on a Friday afternoon. There'd be no video. There would be no, there would just be the cop's words against the witness's words. And, you know, people would be upset, but nothing would happen. And there wouldn't be this kind of critical mass of public debate about these issues. Now you're seeing a national debate about these issues, which is a huge shift.
That's Devlin Barrett. He covers the FBI and the Department of Justice for The Washington Post. Anita Kumar, Politico's White House correspondent, and Fernando Pizarro, a Washington-based political reporter and journalism professor at American University. Thanks to you both, for all of you, for joining us today. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.